Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged, brought to you by Hedgeye Risk Management. Today is March 20th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Well, if you follow markets, and I know that many of you do, this has been a roller coaster 2 weeks, right? And yesterday was an epic dive across all global markets except the safe havens. We certainly have a lot of questions to answer about everything that's recently happened. Which equities crashed and by how much? By sector and country? What's happening to the yield curve? Why is the price of oil crashing at the same time? How is the Fed and the other central banks planning to respond? How are national leaders responding? Will their responses matter much? I mean, let's be honest here. What will happen to the world economy? Is the United States headed for recession? Will this affect the election in 2020? Wow, that's a lot of questions. In one way or in another, I want to say something at least about all of them, so we've got much to talk about. Before going any further, let me remind subscribers of some of the recent reports they should have received since my last podcast. Last Tuesday, I sent out a rather lengthy note called Why COVID-19 is Unstoppable, Yes, Even in China. I've received many interesting questions about this piece from readers. On Thursday, I did a phone interview with our political strategist at Hedgeye, J.T. Taylor, on the Super Tuesday primary, and you can listen to a replay of that if you like. Yesterday, as usual, I did my weekly newswire, and the lead story there was my analysis of one more outrageous dysfunction of our healthcare system, namely our absurd prohibition on any compensation to live kidney donors. You can learn in this piece about a simple policy solution that would save at least 10,000 lives a year, improve the lives of at least 100,000 patients with end-stage renal disease and are currently getting dialysis, and actually save taxpayers, insurers, and patients some $20 or $30 billion annually. And if you think that's impossible, well, read the piece and then tell me I'm wrong. Finally, at 12:30 on Wednesday, that is tomorrow, I'm going to do a live Skype call from our DC office on COVID-19. This will basically be a follow-up to my note last week. I plan to update the numbers, discuss some special virus-related topics, and of course, take questions from you, as many questions as you have. So please tune in and take part. Okay. First, as always, let's look at markets. It's been 2 weeks or 10 market days since my last podcast. And as you all know, those days have been hugely volatile. And they've included some remarkable up days, like last Wednesday when the market was up by 4.3%. But altogether, the S&P 500 has crashed by about 14.9% over the full 10 days, and down by 7.6% yesterday alone. It's regaining a little bit this morning. We'll see where that goes. Yesterday's rout, which started Sunday night in Asia, was so bad that it triggered the circuit breaker in the S&P futures market for the first time since October 27th, 1997. That was some 23 years ago. That day, which coincided with the Asian crisis, was appropriately called Bloody Monday. And that's a name which I guess you could apply to yesterday as well. And then by yesterday morning, as soon as, you know, actual trading on the New York Stock Exchange started, the rapid price fall triggered another circuit breaker. This is the one that halts all trading for 15 minutes after the average price drops 7%. I say all this just to indicate how extreme yesterday's market action was. The VIX closed yesterday at 54.5, which is the highest we've seen since the fall of 2008 and the winter of 2009. So that tells you something about where we are. Compared to its all-time high on February 19th, just 3 weeks ago, the S&P 500 is down nearly 19%, just a bit short of the official bear market threshold. Which sectors have fallen fastest? Energy and financials. Energy due to the, well, partly at least due to the plunge in oil prices, and financials due to the plunge in the yield curve. I'll get back to both of those topics in a minute. Which sectors have fallen the least? Well, as you might expect, the stable ones, consumer staples and healthcare. Yes, we may well need those doctors and clinics. Also, any bond proxy that goes up when long-term rates go down, like utilities or real estate investment trusts. Otherwise, you can distinguish the relative gainers from the relative losers by their perceived risk. Low debt, low beta, low valuation stocks did better. High levered, high beta stocks did worse. Treasuries, precious metals, and safe haven currencies like the yen have done well. High yield debt has gotten punished. Around the rest of the world, the equity plunge was about as steep as it has been here. The global Dow is down 15.2% over the last 10 days and was down 7.7% yesterday. The markets that have declined the least over the last week or month are, oddly enough, in East Asia. China, for example, is only down 11.6% over the last month. Taiwan, Japan, Indonesia, Hong Kong, and South Korea are all down less than 20%, despite being in the center of the whole coronavirus catastrophe. And Japan, after all, has probably already entered a serious recession. The markets that have fallen the most are mainly emerging market economies in Latin America and the weaker economies of Europe, including Russia. Now let's check out the yield curve. The yield curve, the whole length of the yield curve, has fallen at a velocity I just never thought possible. Since my last podcast, again, that's just 10 market days ago, the three-month Treasury yield has fallen by 120 basis points. It is now, as of market close yesterday, at 0.33%, and the 10-year Treasury yield has fallen 84 basis points. Again, as of close yesterday, it was 0.54%. In other words, in just 10 days, the near end has fallen by more than three quarters, and the long end has fallen more than a half. The 30-year Treasury bond is now yielding 0.99%. So for the first time ever, the entire yield curve is now under 1%. In fact, every duration of 5 years or more has now hit record lows. And, you know, it gets even more ridiculous abroad. The German 10-year Bund is now yielding minus 0.85%. That must represent a lot of panic buying by regulated European banks. I mean, seriously, who else would accept such a terrible deal? Well, maybe speculators as well. On the other hand, the yield on Italian and Greek debt, which doesn't say no risk to most investors, well, that's beginning to climb back up. So what can I say about the yield curve collapse? Well, once again, if you've been long treasuries, congratulations. You're richer now than you were last week. I know I'm beginning to sound like a broken record on this, but look, I've been strongly urging you all to be long on the 10-year ever since the yield curve first inverted last spring. And if you've done that, you haven't been disappointed. Also, along with this collapse, the curve has once again de-inverted. This also follows the script I've been giving you for months now. The long end sags, the curve inverts, the Fed cuts, the curve de-inverts, the long end sags again, the curve re-inverts, the Fed cuts. Okay, I think you've got it by now, right? I mean, you just keep doing that cycle over and over. On cue, last Tuesday, the FOMC enacted an emergency rate cut of 0.5%, which sliced the Fed funds rate floor from 1.5 to 1.0%. And yes, on cue, the yield curve de-inverted. But here's the interesting thing. If the Fed funds rate had simply sunk to the Fed's lower bound of 1.0, we would still be brutally inverted given how far the 10-year has gone down. In fact, we would still be inverted by 46 basis points. So this raises an interesting point. Typically, when the markets are not expecting any future Fed cuts or hikes, the 3-month Treasury yield should be very close to the overnight Fed funds rate. After all, why would banks go for a much lower 3-month return than it could get in an overnight return? Unless, that is, banks think that the overnight Fed funds rate will soon be lower. Much lower. Much, much lower. In this case, right at the moment, banks figure that an overnight rate of, an overnight return of 1.1%, and that's the interest rate they can now get on excess reserves, is no better than a 0.33% return on a 3-month bill. That's how convinced the markets are that the Fed is about to undertake a lot more rate slashing, and they're about to undertake it soon. How much rate slashing? Well, it's breathtaking. The CME Group, which imputes its numbers from the Fed funds futures, suggests that as of last night, the Fed will be making bold new moves just 8 days from now at its next official FOMC meeting. It says that there is a 75% likelihood at that time that the Fed will cut by another 0.75%, all the way down to 0.25%. And a 25% likelihood that the Fed will cut all the way to zero at the next meeting. By April 28th, the odds of the Fed hitting the zero bound are 46%, or about 50-50. And amazingly, all the way until the election day in November, the markets see less than a 5% chance of the Fed funds rate being anything greater than 0.25%. Okay, sure, these interest rate futures traders can get it wrong, and I've talked about this before. They tend to be hopelessly complacent when they ought to know that the Fed will have to cut. And maybe, too, they can get panicky and go the other way as well. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see these probabilities pull back in the next few days. Still, even if it's just the market's perception, I think we need to pay attention to that. Are you prepared for the distinct possibility that the Fed could be hitting the zero bound on near-term rates as early as March 18th or April 29th? That would take us all the way back to the bleak old days before the Fed started hiking from zero, and that was back in December of 2015. Only with this difference. Back then, the yield curve had a much steeper and more optimistic slope. Back in 2012 or 2013 or 2014, when the Fed funds rate was zero, the 10-year was typically over 2%, and it never once closed under 1.3%. Right now, I remind you, the 10-year is 0.54%. And if the long end continues to sink and goes into negative territory like Japan and most of Europe has already done, then does the Fed try to push short-term rates into negative territory? For institutional reasons, for cultural reasons, I think that would be very hard to do in America. I've always said that. It would certainly wreck our banking industry. The only other option for the Fed at that point would be a repeat of quantitative easing, of course. Only this time, unlike the first time, the QE may have the interesting effect of pushing the yield curve further into inversion. I mean, this time the Fed would essentially be saying this. At a time when the whole world is buying risk-free long-term debt and driving its yield to unprecedented lows, we think it's a great idea for the Fed to pile on and buy even more of this debt and drive its yield even lower. Maybe markets will buy these arguments. I have my doubts. So if the Fed is out of ammo, and if that happens a lot faster than we were imagining just a few weeks ago, then what's left? Well, there's always fiscal stimulus. Thanks to President Trump and OMB Chief Mick Mulvaney and the GOP Senate, the U.S. economy, at 3.5% unemployment, is already running one of the largest federal deficits as a share of GDP of the post-war era. Our current fiscal year deficit is just over 5% of GDP. But hey, who's to say we can't push that deficit much higher? President Obama, at the depths of the Great Recession, ran federal deficits of roughly 9% of GDP. So maybe that gives us some leeway. Well, it turns out that President Trump is already on it. Last night, he announced that his administration was going to propose some major fiscal stimulus by means of payroll tax cuts to hourly wage earners, along with other assorted subsidies and bailouts, like the cruise industry, for example. So Trump, who just days ago was poo-pooing the market downturn and worries about coronavirus is just another liberal Democratic conspiracy, is now ready to let loose a barrage of extra deficit spending to keep America out of recession. Well, in the long run, I think Trump is onto something. Once the next global recession hits, I think most governments around the world will recognize that monetary policy is mostly out of options and that massive government stimulus of the economy is the only way out. We may even see modern monetary theory popularized in tandem with this new, what should we call it, a new fiscal regimentation of economic life. But the problem for Trump is it will take him a long time to get Congress to agree with such measures and then to get the money out the door. It won't help him deal with the market turmoil likely to unfold this week or the next week or the week after that. So now let's turn back for a moment to the market turmoil itself. What's causing it? Well, the primary cause, as everybody knows, is the ongoing spread of the coronavirus and mounting evidence of its likely impact on the global economy. Outside China, the number of identified cases and deaths from COVID-19 continue to double exponentially about every 4 to 5 days. We're now up to 34,000 cases, up from only 354 cases exactly 1 month ago. I believe that's a 1,000-to-1 ratio, something like that. Inside China, the growth in cases and deaths has been suppressed in part by draconian urban shutdowns and in part by a policy of deliberate undercounting. I spelled out my evidence for this assessment of China in my recent report on COVID-19. How much will the virus actually slow down the global economy? Well, we can't yet measure what it's doing to economic activity outside of China because the virus has been too recent. But we do have some idea of what has happened inside China because there the virus became an epidemic about a month earlier. The numbers for February are already in, and those numbers are pretty bleak. They're pretty stark. China's PMIs, or Purchasing Manager Diffusion Indexes, came in last week for February at literally the lowest levels ever seen. And I mean, they show an economy in sudden deep freeze. For example, the Caixin manufacturing PMI was 40.3. It has never before been below 47. The Caixin services PMI was 26.5. It has never before been below 50. But the Caixin indexes were created relatively recently in 2012. Even more impressive were China's official NBS indexes that date all the way back to 2006. The NBS services PMI was 29.6 and the NBS manufacturing PMI was 35.7. Both of these numbers, again, much lower than any earlier month, even during the Great Recession or, you know, any other time. All of this raises a number of interesting questions. I mean, first of all, will China be able to restart its economy? The government certainly wants people to return to work, and billions of people are desperate for income. But how many people hold back for fear of getting the virus? And how many small businesses will go bankrupt before customers return? Right now, I can tell you the data on subway traffic, rail and plane tickets, migrant traffic, and so on indicate that people are still very slow to return to work and that the deep freeze is largely still on. And then, to the extent that people do go back to work, what are the odds that the transmission of the virus will start accelerating again, what some doctors are calling the possibility of a second wave of infections? In my opinion, people aren't going back to work because the first wave is still more virulent and is claiming more lives than the official Chinese numbers indicate. And then, what does all this imply for high-income economies where the spread of the virus is just now accelerating? And here, clearly, I'm thinking about Italy, Japan, and South Korea. But Spain and France seem to be close behind, and soon after that, the rest of Europe, North America, Australia. Will these countries be pushed by rising cases and deaths to shut down their economies like China has done? Italy isn't there yet, but it does seem to be moving in that direction. Can they do this in a way that does not plunge them into deep recessions? And if they do not, do they risk accelerating the spread of the epidemic within their own borders and from there abroad as well? I don't know the answers to all these questions, but I will give you my opinion. I think that Japan and the Eurozone will almost certainly be in recession by Q2 of this year. And I think that South Korea and Australia are slowing fast and are both very likely to join them. Emerging economies, they're facing broken supply chains, rising credit spreads, and declining industrial demand. I think many of these emerging markets will get hit hard as well. The only big open question is North America. Will the U.S. economy continue to resist the ebb tide going on in the rest of the world? Or will it also suffer some significant income and production declines? Speaking of declining industrial demand, let me turn back to the one other big hit to global markets last weekend, and that was the swan dive in the price of crude oil from $45 per barrel last Thursday to $32 yesterday. That's minus 30%. Quite a step down. What set the stage for the drop was, again, a steady downward global pressure on oil consumption and prices over the last 18 months, and that was due to cooling global trade and industrial production. But what delivered the sudden hit last weekend was Russia's refusal to go along with Saudi Arabia's steady long-range plan to ratchet down oil production by all the major oil producers, and in that way, to keep the price higher. Why did Russia refuse? Well, apparently, Putin is furious that American shale oil producers are getting a free ride from all this production cutting by OPEC and its Vienna Group allies. U.S. producers sure aren't cutting their production. Putin thinks that a somewhat lower price would put a lot of high-cost U.S. producers out of business. So he favors a higher production, lower price strategy. As it turned out, MBS and the Saudis disagreed, possibly because they need a higher price to meet their fiscal demands. Maybe they want to please all their new investors now that Aramco is going public. Anyway, the Saudis decided to punish Russia by going the other way, by lowering the price and apparently by planning to step up production over the next year. All that's as if to say to Russia, okay, if you don't play by our rules, just see how long you can bear this pain. That pain, of course, will be borne by all oil producers around the world. The lower price will put extra economic pressure not just on Russia, where equities are down by one-third over the past month, but also on the other Gulf states, on Iran and Venezuela, on Nigeria, on Norway, and, well, all the oil exporters. It may also pose a huge threat to the U.S. energy sector, and Putin is right about that. If oil stays at around $30 to $35, many more U.S. energy companies will go out of business, and the risk premia on high-yield debt will get pushed upward. And think about this, to the extent that a lot of U.S. companies in all sectors rely on rolling over high-yield debt. This is a bad stressor coming at a bad time. Well, now let me say a few words about economic indicators, though there wasn't much to report. Outside of China, I think most people are pretty much ignoring what happened in February and are looking forward with dread to what's going to get reported for March and April. In the U.S., for example, we got a very good non-farm payroll employment number for February. 273,000 jobs added, but it had just about zero impact on markets last week. I think actually that the number was anomalous because turns out that the census household survey releases for the last 2 months have actually indicated no change at all in net employment. And though the census number is more volatile, the establishment NFP number does tend to regress toward it over time. Otherwise, the U.S. picture was mixed. All the February ISM PMIs for manufacturing and services were high and rising. But this good news was canceled out by final market PMIs for composite and services that were low, that is to say below 50, and falling. So I don't think we get any net picture on that. In Asia, we've already looked at China's February deep freeze. The data from Japan and South Korea were all on the downside, with PMIs, reported PMIs, all under 50. One new worry is Australia, which is really suffering from the industrial slowdown in East Asia and now from the decline in energy prices. Australia's manufacturing PMI for February came in at 44.3. That's not good. And its services PMI has been at 47 for the second month in a row. Also, in the last 2 months, month-over-month retail sales have been declining at an average rate of minus 0.5%. The central bank has just cut its policy interest rate to 0.5%. As I pointed out earlier, Australia is now on my recession watch. In Europe, there was really no notable economic news. What's more interesting in Europe is the emerging political and policy response to the twin threats of coronavirus and recession. Christine Lagarde at the ECB would surely like to do something grand and sweeping, but it doesn't look like she has many options after years of Mario Draghi's rate cutting. The ECB interest rate is already at minus 0.5%. Oh, well, that's about the lowest central bank rate in the world, and no one thinks further cutting there would help much. She could also expand asset purchases and buy up more sovereign and corporate debt in Europe, but that's kind of the same old, isn't it? On the fiscal side, the prime ministers of France and Italy, Bruno Le Maire and Giuseppe Conte, are asking the EU to undertake a huge new stimulus program, something like what Shinzo Abe has just proposed in Japan. To do that, they want to loosen the EU's customary budget rules. Europe cannot think of confronting an extraordinary situation with ordinary measures. That's what Giuseppe Conte said the other day. And Mario Salvini, the right-wing leader of Lega, and who's usually a fierce critic of the Conte government, this time he weighed in on Conte's side. He basically said that this was a critical test of the EU's relevance. If the EU cannot get together and act decisively, Salvini said, then the EU is essentially dead. And that's the word he used, dead, although I think Salvini probably would already wishes that the EU were dead. Well, we'll see what happens. In particular, we'll see how Germany responds to all these new schemes. Whenever the rest of Europe talks about spending more, Germany's usually attitude is, sure, you all want to spend more out of our pockets. The Germans will undoubtedly drag their feet on this one. It might have been different if Germany had been initially hit hardest by the virus instead of Italy, France, and Spain. But that's not the way it turned out, did it? German health officials are suggesting that Germany's low death count thus far is somehow attributable to their superior diligence in tracking the virus. I very much doubt that. I think the infections just started later in Germany. In time, Germany will want to mobilize, but right now a lot of Europeans don't think they have the luxury of waiting for Germany. Well, now, finally, let me turn to politics in the United States and to the hottest issue in U.S. politics, and that is the amazing up-and-down story of the 2020 Democratic primary. Just 2 weeks ago, before the South Carolina primary, it looked like Joe Biden was politically dead. Everyone was writing his obituary, and it looked like Bernie Sanders had the nomination locked up. I said as much myself in my podcast 2 weeks ago. Well, that has certainly changed. On February 29th, Biden won a surprisingly solid victory in South Carolina based on very large margins in the African-American vote. And then on Super Tuesday, a few days later, he got a huge surge of support from late deciding voters and won 10 states. Bernie Sanders only won 4. Biden is currently leading Sanders in the delegate count, 670 to 574, and he has all the momentum behind him. Turns out all the other nominees are dropping out and endorsing Biden, including Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar and Mike Bloomberg. Even candidates who dropped out months ago, like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, are now announcing that they're backing Biden. Over just the last week, Biden's support in national polls among Democrats has soared from 19% to 51%. Sanders is also benefiting from other candidates dropping out, but much less so. He's risen to only 35%. So apparently, most Democratic voters are galvanizing around Biden as their only realistic hope to beat Donald Trump in November. So, is it all over for Sanders? I'll be honest, the odds certainly do favor Biden at this point, but I think Sanders still has a shot. First of all, Sanders won't quit. As he showed against Hillary Clinton back in 2016, he never gives up, and he's capable of big comebacks late in the game. And he knows, particularly this election, how volatile the opinion polls ratings can be. Secondly, Biden is prone to horrible gaffes, and sometimes his befuddled and absent-minded debate performances make viewers wonder about his fitness for the office. Both of these men are in their late 70s, but it's Biden, not Sanders, who shows signs of declining capability. And finally, while Democrats really want to rally around one person, and they've decided for now that Biden is that one person, it turns out few Democrats are actually enthusiastic about Biden. He's everyone's kind of regrettable choice. Unlike Bernie Sanders, unlike Donald Trump, for that matter, Joe Biden doesn't really have a core of committed fans. So does Sanders still have a chance? Well, he does, but his time is running out. He needs to perform well in the near term. Indeed, he needs to perform well today, March 10th, in a primary that will decide 6 more states. Some of these you can already tell what's likely to happen. Biden is very likely to win today in Mississippi and Missouri, and Sanders is very likely to win in Idaho, North Dakota, and certainly in Washington State. That leaves one big state. That leaves Michigan. That's the state that everyone is watching. If Bernie loses Michigan by a significant margin, well, then maybe we can start really marking down his odds. But if he wins, or just comes really close, his campaign could recapture vital momentum. Right now, Biden is ahead in the polls in Michigan by 22 percentage points. Well, that sounds like a lot. But remember, that was exactly how much Hillary Clinton was ahead of Bernie Sanders in Michigan back in 2016 by 21 percentage points. And that's when Bernie staged an amazing come-from-behind victory and beat her. So, we'll know a lot more late tonight or tomorrow. Is Bernie still in the thick of it? Or are all the progressives going to be rending their clothes and covering themselves with ashes? We'll find out. Thanks for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged. Talk to you next week. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Demography Unplugged. Tune in next time. If you have any questions about this broadcast or have suggestions for future topics, please contact qademography@hedgeye.com. Also, if you'd like to see more of what I have to offer, visit us online at hedgeye.com, and also make sure to follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E, Generation.
Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.